This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross. The new anthology Best American Comics 2006 was edited by Harvey Pekar, who's best known for his own series of autobiographical comics, American Splendor. In that series, which he began in 1976, he chronicled the day-to-day aspects of his life. Things like working as a file clerk at a VA hospital in Cleveland, collecting jazz records, running into annoying friends and strangers, the ups and downs of married life, and being constantly disgruntled by how little money he makes. Pekar's life was dramatized in the 2003 movie American Splendor, in which he was portrayed, brilliantly, by Paul Giamatti. The movie ended with Pekar's retirement from his file clerk job. Having ended that portion of his life, Pekar since has used his art to look back to an earlier part of his life. Last year, he published a memoir about his childhood. It's a book-length comic called The Quitter, and it's now out in paperback. Pekar writes his comics and has worked with several different illustrators, including his old friend R. Crumb. The Quitter is illustrated by Dean Hospiel. Terry spoke with Harvey Pekar last year and asked him about one unexpected part of his childhood.
What really surprised me reading your new book was that you were a street fighter when you were young. You always struck me as more argumentative, but not as someone who would enjoy a good fist fight. So, I don't know. Is this like a more hidden part of your past?
Well, I guess it's hidden if you don't know about it. I didn't write very much about my early life in previous issues of American Splendor, and so I didn't talk about it. It used to be a big part of my life, and I didn't used to really enjoy beating up people. What I used to enjoy was the acclaim and stuff. You know, I was living in a neighborhood where the toughest guy was, got the most respect. And, I wasn't getting a whole lot of respect in those days. And I didn't used to pick fights, but, if I'd get in an argument with a guy, and it'd go to a certain point or he'd start cursing at me or something, I'd smack him.
Well, let's go back to the neighborhood you grew up in. You write that, when you were growing up, your parents were Jewish immigrants from Poland. You'd lived in a neighborhood that had become predominantly African-American, so you were one of the few white kids in your school, and you actually got beaten up a lot. How did it affect your self-image to be beaten up a lot?
I didn't like it. I mean, it really messed me up. Every day when I would come back from school or go to, back to my house for lunch or something like that during lunch break, there'd be a bunch of guys, that would jump me. And I had to fight through that kind of scene for, a couple of years. And nobody talked to me on the street. I was just, completely shunned. And as a result, I actually started to think of myself as some kind of an inferior. And,
Why do you think you were picked on so much? Did it have to do with being white or being what they considered nerdy? What was it, do you think?
Well, it was being white. They used to call me White Cracker. That was my nickname. And so I would just, be by myself all the time. I got going when I started reading. That helped me out a lot. I learned how to read, and I would read comic books and stuff, and that helped.
Well, I think it was when you were in high school, your family moved to a different neighborhood, and this was a predominantly white neighborhood. And then instead of being picked on all the time, you turned into a bully. How did that happen?
I didn't exactly turn into a bully. It's just gradually... I'm pretty strong for my age. I mean, I was pretty strong for my size and my age in those days, and I was a pretty decent athlete. I never got a chance to find out about this until I moved to this other neighborhood, because I like, for instance, when I was fighting, I would always be fighting several guys at once. and I never had a chance to participate in sports or anything like that because I was sort of, you know, just left out of it. Nobody wanted me.
So in high school, you feel like you didn't exactly turn into a bully, but now that you were fighting one-on-one instead of one against a group, you did well. You won most of your fights. So
yeah.
How did that change how you carried yourself in school and how you thought of yourself?
Well, I was a lot more confident about myself because, you know, I bought into this idea that the toughest kid was the most respected kid. And I figured that I was the most respected kid. And I noticed that even though, I read a lot and I was kind of scholarly in some ways, nobody used to give me a hard time about it because they know I would fight back.
Your new book is called The Quitter. What are some of the things you quit when you were younger?
Well, I quit baseball. I quit football. I quit classes in school that challenged me to take easier classes. Then after I got out of high school, I got a bunch of jobs and some of them I quit because I had these, you know, kind of crazy fears about just being a failure no matter what I did. Like, for example, in the post office, so I worked at the post office and I would be afraid to, I would think I was going to be screwing up if I bound up bundles of letters and twine because I thought I was so mechanically incompetent that I wouldn't tie them tightly enough and they would come apart and the bosses would blame me for screwing up, you know. So before that could happen, I quit. I know it sounds crazy, but yeah, you know, it was kind of a crazy scene. And there wasn't really much I could do about it.
You joined the Navy, and you didn't quit that, but you were asked to leave.
Yeah, I was asked to leave because with the mechanical stuff, I couldn't pass inspections. I just got all hung up about the, about washing my own clothes, and I couldn't tell whether my clothes were dirty or clean, and I would be standing there at the sink, scrubbing my clothes whenever everybody else was through, and I wouldn't know whether they were clean or dirty.
You were told that you didn't have the flexibility for Navy life.
Yeah, that was officially what they said. Well, I guess I didn't. Not that I really loved the Navy that much, but I was just looking for a place to land, a place that I could survive, you know, some kind of job, something. After a while, I set my sights really low. You know, I just wanted to find something that was easy and paid me enough that I could just barely get by, and something that was steady. And you know, finally, I found that in the civil service, working for the VA hospital
as a file clerk.
That's right. I have a total of 37 years in with the federal government as a file clerk.
And you did that till your retirement. And here's something I find really interesting. Your book is called The Quitter. As a young man and as a high school student, you quit all kinds of things. But you've also had incredible stick-to-itiveness. I mean, you stayed at this one job for, 37 years. You started doing comics when you were, in your 20s? 32. Okay, and you're about 65 now, and you're still doing them, and you've done them, and you're now like pretty well known for them. You've been married how many years?
Well, this last time I've been married for 22 years.
That's a pretty long time. And you've been in your house how long?
I've been in my house about 15 years.
Yeah, that's a pretty long time, too. So how do you kind of reconcile the part of you that's a quitter with the part of you that kind of finds something and just stays with it?
Well, when I find something I can handle, you know, that doesn't, you know, mess me up or anything like that, I stick to it. I hold on to it with a death grip, like my civil service job. God, I thought, God, I'll never find another job like this again. You know, it's so ideal for me, you know. It's easy. I don't have to go home and worry about the work. I just go and, you know, do the work and go home and think about writing something. And, you know, I had health insurance. And so, I mean, why wouldn't I want to stay with that? I didn't think I possibly could do any better than that. I thought that was the best I could possibly do. And, you know, maybe I was right.
Now, what about sticking with American Splendor, the comic series that you've been doing for about 30 years or more? Did you, you know, it didn't start out, I mean, it hasn't, until the American Splendor movie, it wasn't, and maybe even after that, it hasn't been like a very lucrative thing. And the attention that you've gotten for it came, I think, kind of slowly. So what kept you doing it even when you weren't getting a lot of, like, financial awards or acclaim or recognition?
Well, I did get some critical notice, and that was a big thing to me. I mean, it was a big thing to me to be a writer. And I was, like, sort of on a mission with American Splendor, too. I wanted to try to prove that comics could do things. I wanted to expand them beyond superheroes and talking animals. And I knew that was going to take a long time, but I just started, you know, writing autobiography and about, you know, my quotidian life. And, you know, because I think everybody's life's interesting, and I just kept on going at it, and I developed a small group of followers that, you know, used to write to me, and I mean, it was like I had some, you know, people say get a life. Well, I mean, that was part of my life, you know. It was a social connection. Other than that, I really didn't have too much. I would just get up and go to work and come home.
Did you have to learn how to deal with an unstructured day, a day that wasn't structured by a 9-to-5 job?
Yeah, I did. I at first it freaked me out. In fact, you know, I got so depressed and screwed up, I was hospitalized, you know, for major depression.
When was this?
Well, I retired like in October of 2001, and then in November they shot the movie, and then I had a good time going down onto the set and watching them shooting the movie and stuff, but when it was over, it was like there was no structure in my life. And I think maybe this happens to a lot of guys when they retire. And I just got real nervous and depressed and had to be hospitalized for it. And for about a year and a half, I was in and out of the hospital several times until I just made up my mind that, first of all, you know, being in the hospital wasn't going to help me. And I just have to grit my teeth and just do what I had to do or you know, die trying or something.
Do you think that the depression was brought on in part by having to face a lot of writing, or do you think it was brought on in part by facing the kind of void in existence that can be brought on when you don't have things that are kind of occupying you on a regular basis?
Right. I hadn't really faced up to the idea of structuring my time in my life, and I you know, people could maybe warn me about it, but until I actually faced the problem, it didn't, you know, I didn't realize how serious it was.
How do you think it's affected your life to have put so much of your personal life out there? In your comics over the years, you've written about, you know, fights with your wife and, you know, arguments with friends and workers and insecurities that you have. I mean, it seems like all kinds of things that go through your mind or all kinds of things that you've experienced for better and for worse have ended up in your comics over the years. And your goal in these comics isn't to just present yourself in a flattering light. It's to try, I think it's to try to be really honest about what day-to-day life is like. How has that affected you to have all of that out there?
Well, I don't mind it if I show myself being cheap or, you know, being, you know, unreasonable sometimes. You know, at least I haven't killed anybody. And so that, you know, that's not a problem for me. If I did something really heinous, I guess I wouldn't want to write about it. But I've continued to write about my life as it is, hoping that people will identify with, you know, some of the things that I do, some of the things that I think, and you know, take maybe even comfort. Like, for example, when my wife and I did this book, Our Cancer Year, it didn't sell very well. I think it's the worst selling of all my, square back books.
And this was a journal of when you had cancer.
Right.
In comic form.
Right. It was something like 212 pages about what it was like having cancer and what it was like for my wife to take care of me. And people have ever since then, you know, told me that they really, you know, it was really important for them to read that book because, you know, they thought that maybe they were the only one that was going through this stuff. And I guess when their experience was universalized, I guess it made it a little easier to take.
You know, when I think about your life, I think about somebody who has this almost like an inherently bohemian spirit. You know, somebody whose life is so caught up in jazz and literature and language. And yet you spend so much of your life having this really straight 9-to-5 file clerk job. And do you see that as a paradox of your life? You know, leading this like very straight life, but at the same time being just kind of an inherently bohemian at the same time?
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I just tried to live on, you know, on two different levels. I knew I couldn't make money at the stuff I liked doing. So I took a job that was not challenging. And, when it was slow at work, I used to sneak off in a corner and read, as a matter of fact. I would take books with me all the time to work. I could get my work done, you know, pretty quickly, and I would, you know, like, I would sneak off someplace to, you know, to read or write. It worked out. I guess if I'd have had a tougher job, maybe I wouldn't have read so much.
Well, Harvey Pekar, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
Harvey Pekar, speaking with Terry Gross last year. He's just edited a new anthology collection called Best American Comics 2006.